Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Lucy Suchek. Today, we take you to the first annual Governor Mills Opioid Response Summit at the Augusta Civic Center for a keynote talk by Michael Botticelli, former White House Director of National Drug Control Policy. The title of this event is Turning the Tide, Maine's Path Forward in Addressing the Opioid Crisis. Michael Botticelli is the Executive Director of the Graykin Center for Addiction at the Boston Medical Center. He is a distinguished policy scholar at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time, and it will be archived on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to hear the program again at your convenience and to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. The program will also be available as a podcast. Introducing our speaker today is Aaron Fry, Attorney General of Maine.
Good afternoon. I want to start off by expressing my gratitude to Governor Mills, to Gordon Smith, to families like the Yankowskis, who are taking this step forward to start and engage in a meaningful way in what it is that we have to do to address what is really, really a serious epidemic here in the state right now, which is the opiate crisis. It's a crisis that has been building for a long, long time, and thanks to the energy of folks like Governor Mill, who is AG, did a lot of work to make sure that naloxone was available for first responders, for law enforcement agencies to save lives. This is the kind of work that is energizing me in my role as Attorney General, in that, you know, back when I first started in the legislature, we were fighting over whether or not to make naloxone available to law enforcement agencies. We actually lost that bill. We lost that legislation in my first term. It took 4 years to get to a point where we could have some sort of public policy consensus that that was the right thing to do. It was always the right thing to do, but it was hard to get there. And it's thanks to folks like the governor, like Gordon Smith, like folks here in this room who worked hard in their communities, in their businesses, in their homes, to make sure that folks that had substance use disorder knew that they were accepted, that they were going to get help to get over their recovery, to get through their recovery. But even if they stumbled, that there was always going to be a door open to make sure that they could move forward. Because, you know, this epidemic is causing a generation to be put in peril, right? And it's not just criminal defendants. That's the way that folks looked at this epidemic for a long time, that it was just individuals that needed to be prosecuted. The folks that came into my office when I was in private practice, they weren't just those that were charged with crimes. They were also parents who, because of their substance use disorder, because of their addiction to opiates, because of how that disease had manifested, they were not able to take care of their children. We see that now still in the state of Maine, where a child protective system is working really hard to make sure that parents who are struggling with their addiction and the children who are part of this, you know, making sure that there's some pathway forward should they be able to take it. Additionally, employment. We see a number of employers who have struggled with how it is that they can maintain their employee base, skilled employee base, while the individuals that they employ are dealing with a substance use disorder. We've had some proactive employers in Maine who have actually agreed to pay for their employees to go through rehabilitation because of their commitment to making sure that that disease was addressed. So my hope is that with the energy that we have here in this room today, with the work that the governor and her administration is going to be doing, with the work that I hope to contribute to as Attorney General, there is really some important steps that we're going to be able to take. I think it's turning the tide is what the name of this summit is. We really have the opportunity to turn the tide. And somebody that I am very pleased to introduce, I've seen him speak before. If you go online and you look up Michael Botticelli, you will be inspired in how it is that you can engage in a meaningful way in helping people who have substance use disorder transition. This is an individual who most notably served as President Obama's Director of National Drug Control Policy. He served in that office from 2012, but he really became director in 2015 after a unanimous Senate vote. That's hard to get in the United States Senate. And he got a unanimous Senate vote, and you're going to see why in a little bit. I did get the advanced copy of his PowerPoint, and we're really in for a treat today because of the energy that he has. Now, as director of the National Drug Control Policy Office, he was doing the kind of work that I'm looking forward to us doing here in Maine, and that was work to reduce prescription drug abuse, heroin, and related overdoses. This included things like community-based prevention efforts, educating prescribers and the public about preventing public prescription drug abuse, expanding the use of life-saving overdose reversal drugs like naloxone, and it goes on and on. This was all proactive work, and by the way, even though this was just 4 years ago, this was pretty proactive stuff. This was pretty progressive stuff. This was stuff that Mr. Bonicelli had done when he was serving as the director of Bureau of Substance Abuse Services in Massachusetts. He had done it. He had a pattern to do it. He took it to the national level, and he's bringing it here today. He does continue to work in this field. He works as the executive director at the Graykin Center for Addiction in Boston Medical Center. It's something that he has been spearheading in something programs that are really looking to make sure people are connected, not just coming into the emergency rooms, not just coming in at their point of crisis, but trying to transition them to how it is that they can get well, get better, and get the support that they need. So Mr. Bonicelli, please come on up and talk to us about how we can do better here in Maine.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. It's really a pleasure to be here. And I asked the Attorney General to be brief in my bio, but there is one kind of critical ingredient that he missed, and that's the fact that I am only here through the fact that I've been in recovery. So if you had asked me over 30 years ago if I'd be standing in front of the governor of the state of Maine and my good friend Secretary Lambrou to say that I'd be addressing all of you, or that I would have been the director of drug policy for President Obama, I think you would have thought me crazy. But it's really why I'm here and why I'm able to do this work. So I really want to thank Governor Mills. Having been doing this work for a long time, particularly doing this work in New England for a very long time, have seen the dramatic 180-degree turn that the state has taken as it relates to this issue. I worked with her closely when she was Attorney General. It's a privilege. And I'm also thrilled that we all know that she's really smart and that she picks really smart people to work for her. And Secretary Lambrou, it was a pleasure to work with you in the White House. And you know, she was at our table where we were talking, she was very humble about the work. And I'm like, this is the woman that implemented the Affordable Care Act. it's really, I'm really privileged to be here with my partner in recovery and my partner in crime, Tom Coderre. And so he was at SAMHSA when I was at ONDCP. And I think it just goes to show you the role that people recovery should play and deserve to play at the every single table. So there was an expression in the AIDS epidemic, nothing about us without us. And Gordon, the conference that you put together, where'd he go? He's probably out and about. But the way that you have incorporated people in recovery and their voice is really important. I've been to way too many conferences with too many academic talking heads without the voice of parents and people in recovery to do that. So Sam Quinones and your family, it's great to see you again. This is I think the third or fourth time that I've had the unenviable task of following you, really privileged. So I wanna spend a little bit of time, and the governor and Sam talked about it, of really taking a step back and say, how did we get here? Because I think it's really important for us to understand, you know, how did we get to this point where more people in the United States are dying of drug overdoses than motor vehicle fatalities and gunshots? How did we get here? But I also think it's important because it helps chart our course forward in terms of the work that we're doing. But before I do that, I have to give a shameless plug because I am, being from Massachusetts, I know what some of you people call people from Massachusetts. So I want you to know that for 20 years, my husband and I have had a place right down the road in Wayne, Maine. And so this is, And if you haven't been to Tubby's Ice Cream, you have to go. The best ice cream in Maine. So I just want you to know that I have some credibility. So just a little bit about Boston Medical Center. So we are the largest safety net institution in New England. We are also have an associated health plan of over 400,000 people. Most of our patients are on Medicaid or are uninsured, and we also have an affiliated medical school. But I also have to say, unusual to many hospitals and health systems, we have been dealing with issues of addiction for over 30 years. And I think, quite honestly, we'll talk a little bit about it, but and I think you've heard some stories today from Andrew, who talked about how hard it was to get care in terms of calling our medical institutions. So we know about 22 million people in the United States have a substance use disorder. But unfortunately, and this figure like is astonishing to me every time I say it, that only about nine out of 10 people actually do not receive treatment, right? So substance use disorders have roughly the prevalence of diabetes. But about 85% of people with diabetes actually get care and treatment. And I often say it's the abject failure of our healthcare delivery system to identify and treat people with substance use disorders. We also know that this epidemic has had an extraordinary economic burden. We have been working with many employers, similarly in Massachusetts, that can't find people to work for them. They know they are paying extraordinary healthcare costs. As a medical system, we have 6,000 employees and their families. And we took a look at our own data, and we understood the magnitude of the issue as it relates to our own employees. And I think it's important for us, both as employers and as community members, that we deal with this issue. We have extraordinary number of clinical programs. I think what we like to do is to say that we identify people wherever they touch us within the hospital system. So whether that's in a primary care visit, in the emergency department, in our neonatal unit, we want to make sure that we're identifying people and engaging them in evidence-based care. So we talked about it, and Sam talked about some of the drivers, but I want to do a little bit deeper dive into some of them. I want to talk about kind of what existed before the opioid prescribing happened, talk a little bit more about pharmaceutical industry practices, about the historic undertreatment and untreating addiction in the United States. Certainly the overprescription of pain medication, the emergence of fentanyl and heroin. But I also think it's important, and you know, the governor talked about this, Sam talked about this, that we really have to start getting to root cause issues here. How do we think about those social determinants of health? Things like poverty and racism and isolation, histories of violence and trauma in our community, lack of educational and vocational opportunities. We are the only Western country that for 2 years in a row has seen overall decreases in life expectancy. Think about that. Think about the money that we spend on healthcare, and we're still seeing. And why do you think of that, right? So these are what have been classified as diseases of despair, right? So it's drug overdoses, suicides, and diseases related to alcohol abuse. So you tell me, you look at that numbers, those numbers, and tell me something is not fundamentally going wrong with our communities in terms of that kinds of diseases of despair. So as we're talking about the opioid epidemic, I think it's really important that's already been articulated today, that this is about how do we create meaning and purpose and community in people's lives. The longer I do this work, the longer I've come to the conclusion that that is where the long-term remedy for this epidemic and for every other epidemic. So Sam talked really, I think, clearly and articulately and passionately about kind of, you know, the marketing of prescription pain medications and the cartels. But I think it's really important that we take a step back even further, right? I'm not an epidemiologist, but epidemics don't happen in a vacuum. Conditions have to be ripe for epidemics to take hold. Right? And so I want to talk about those because I think it's really important that we understand that. And we talked about, and I can't give a talk without first and foremost talking about the role that stigma has played. So the governor talked about, you know, kind of the overwhelming response we'd see if 1,000 SEALs washed up. And that's how stigma manifests itself. It's addiction has been seen of a disease of other, and it's been highly stigmatized that people did it to themselves. So why as a society should we care about them? Stigma manifests itself at the individual level, and this is particularly true for me. You know, I thought I was a pretty smart guy, right? You know, I had a couple letters after my name, and I was working for a, you know, highly respected academic institution in Boston, and I knew I needed help. I knew I needed help, but I was too afraid to ask for it. because I thought people would think that I was stupid, that I was morally flawed. I was worried that it was going to affect my career. And that's how stigma manifests itself on the individual level. We know that people often avoid seeking care and delaying seeking care. We also know it manifests itself at the clinical level. Numerous studies show that people who intersect with our healthcare delivery system feel treated with disrespect and shame, whether they're talking with a primary care provider, whether they're going to our emergency room. So we know that we have to do a better job in terms of training our medical staff around this. We also know that it's emblematic in media coverage, right? So think about the language that media use as we're, you know, people are junkies or they're addicts. You know, we use these highly pejorative terms. And often, you know, the media never really talks about the success of people who go on to get treatment and great recovery stories that we hear. It's usually the gloom and doom of this epidemic, and it's not very evidence-based. And they've often said really disparaging things about highly effective treatments that we have. So how we work with media becomes, I think, particularly important. And it's also reflective in our language. So, and you know, I'm a person in recovery, so I'll cop to my own, right? So how many, you know, people are in recovery here, how many people, like, use the, you don't have to raise your hand, of how much clean time you have? Right? So what's the opposite of that? Right? You know, so, or the results of urine toxicology screens, you know, dirty, right? We don't use those words with any other disease. And so it really does manifest itself in our language and, you know, particularly important for me in terms of our public policy. And I'll talk a little bit about more. So my former office in Washington, I was actually the first person to come from a public health background. I was the first person in recovery to hold the job. And I think it was also emblematic of the history of policies and funding that for our office. So the Office of National Drug Control Policy was started in 1988 by Congress, had two main functions. One, set the administration's drug policy strategy. And two, we were also tasked with basically working with all those different federal agencies and coming up with the administration's drug control budget, right? Office of Management and Budget didn't like it very much, but that was our job. And if you look at the history of federal funding as it relates to this issue, the vast majority of funding was spent on law enforcement and supply reduction, right? Supply reduction means, you know, eradicating coca in cocaine and pulling out poppy in Mexico and, you know, interdicting cocaine on the high seas and arresting and incarcerating people. And I'm not saying that supply reduction is not important to our work. Think of fentanyl and fentanyl supply issues. But the vast majority of funding was spent on those approaches and comparatively little on public health approaches, prevention, intervention, treatment, and recovery. And it was actually not until the end of the Obama administration, largely as a result of the Affordable Care Act and the passage of 21st Century Cures, that for the first time in the history of the country, we were spending at least the same amount on health approaches that we were on supply reduction and law enforcement approaches. I would like to think that that's continued, but we have every reason to believe that it's not, and particularly as this administration continues to want to strike down the Affordable Care Act, which by all account is the very mechanism by which the vast majority of people in the United States are getting access to evidence-based care. We also have seen, quite honestly, the history of separate care and delivery systems for mental health and substance use disorders versus primary care. And my simplistic way of explaining it is, don't do it now, but if you pull out your insurance card, you'll probably have two numbers. Right? If you have a medical condition, call this number. If you have a behavioral health condition, call this number. Despite the fact that we know, and Andrew talked about it dramatically, he not only needed care for his addiction, but he needed care for all the other health conditions that they have. So we've had separate care and delivery systems for mental health and substance use disorders in primary care, when the Institute of Medicine says that good health is a three-legged stool. Mental health, substance use, and primary care, and that we cannot expect to get good outcomes in any one of those domains if we're not paying attention to all three. So the other piece that existed even prior to the overprescribing was little to no training in any medical school, in any nursing school, in any dental school, on substance use disorders. And again, this is probably the most prevalent disease condition that people are gonna face, right? But we have let, as a society, addiction and understanding it be an optional healthcare activity. So can you imagine if we said to people in medical school, you know what, diabetes is gonna be something that you're gonna face, but we're not gonna teach you about it. we're not going to give you any sort of identification. And so it's really interesting. The General Accountability Office actually did a study on pain training in the United States and found that veterinarians actually get more pain training in the United States than physicians do, right? So we kind of wonder why we have. And I'll talk about something that we're doing at Boston Medical Center. We also know that there is a long history of inadequate healthcare coverage around substance use disorders, where insurance companies either didn't have a benefit or didn't have a benefit that it was on any sort of par with medical benefits that they were providing, as well as long histories of discriminatory insurance practices. So different lifetime limitations, higher copays and deductibles. And it's a battle that, quite honestly, I think we still face today in achieving true insurance parity for mental health and substance use disorders. And it's important for all of us to pay attention. So as a result of that, only a very, very small percentage of patients are diagnosed and get into care, right? So addiction is the only disease where we basically tell people you have to self-diagnose that you have an addiction, right? You have to come to an awareness, right? We don't do that with diabetes. We don't do it with HIV. We don't do it with any other condition. What I want to know is how many people have ever been diagnosed as having a substance use disorder. Not did you know you have a substance use disorder, but that's what we often do. And we use expressions like hitting bottom. Right? What other disease condition do we tell people you have to hit bottom before we can motivate you to seek care? We don't say to people with hypertension, you know, let's wait till you have a heart attack, and then we're going to motivate you to seek care. Right? So I am, unfortunately, until fairly recently, a lifelong smoker. Many people with substance use disorders struggle with nicotine addiction, and I have for a very long time. My doc did not tell me to go away and come back when I'm ready to stop. Right? He continued to engage me. How can we support you? Can we get you on nicotine replacement therapy? But for addiction, we don't. We categorically ignore it, and we tell people to come back to us when you've had enough and you're ready to stop. So I think what's really telling, of the very small percentage of people who get treatment, the largest referral source to treatment is our criminal justice system, right? So not only do we wait till people reach their acute condition, but it's often as a result of criminal behavior, yours truly, right, that identifies and steers people to treatment. So, you know, despite the fact that I had a genetic predisposition, I started drinking at a very young age, it wasn't until I was arrested for drunk driving that a judge said to me, Michael, I think you need help, and I'm gonna, like, make sure that you get it. It wasn't a primary care provider, it wasn't a pediatrician, it wasn't a school nurse who, you know, said, Michael, you're at high risk, that we're gonna monitor you for symptoms all along the way. Only 8% of referrals to addiction treatment are coming from our healthcare delivery system, despite the fact that many people with substance use disorders overutilize our healthcare system. So it talks about what we have to do. And of those who are getting care, and I think it's beginning to change, even though it's a chronic disease, we still, I think, are in a place where treatment is acute and a very short duration. So we have to continue to expose our continuum of care. So this is an example. These are some colleagues of mine at Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. And this really, I think, exemplifies how stigma manifests itself in discriminatory public policy. So this looked at Americans' attitudes around people with addiction, even compared to people with mental health. And I won't go through all of them, but I just highlighted a few here. 43% of people oppose giving health benefits to people with a substance use disorder versus a mental health. 64% said that we should deny employment. 54% said that we should deny housing, despite the fact that we know that stable employment and stable housing are two of the biggest building blocks of people's long-term recovery. So I think it's a really kind of startling example of how stigma manifests itself in terms of public policy. So, you know, lest you think that Massachusetts is any better, this is a survey that was done last spring by Blue Cross Blue Shield in Massachusetts. And so, you know, a couple bright spots here. So the majority of people thought it was a public health issue, that we should deal with this as a public health issue. That's good. But 4 in 10 believe that only 4 in 10 believe that addiction is a disease, and 3 in 10 believe addiction is a choice, right? So I can tell you that there are probably not many people who go on to have a substance use disorder who consciously chose to have a substance use disorder, right? Like most chronic conditions, we know about 50% is genetic, and 50% is often attributable to other circumstances. And, you know, we know that for many, many people, risk is really, really high. And yes, you may start using on your own. But the neurobiology of addiction basically, affects that part of your brain that's responsible for choice and judgment. So I think we have a lot of work to do together in educating our colleagues, our community members, our neighbors around addiction. And lastly, 82% believe that people with addiction bear all, most, or some of the blame for their addiction. So even in good old Massachusetts, we still have a long way to go in terms of how do we do a better job of educating the public that this is a disease. And this is, again, this is from the General Social Survey. Sorry, I forgot to put the site on this. In terms of Americans' attitudes that the government spends too little on drug rehabilitation, right? And so you see, so what happened in 2012? Well, we had parents, quite honestly, speaking up and speaking out about this issue. And this is when the opioid epidemic really started to take hold. And there we see, significant increases in public attitudes around government spending for addiction. I will tell you, I won't speak on behalf of all the electeds in this room, but those of us who did government work for a very long time need outside advocacy and outside pressure to help us do what we need to do. If the general public doesn't think we're spending enough, then it's really hard just to have an internal push for much of that work. So it's really important to do that. I think we have to acknowledge that the opioid epidemic has been taking a long toll on many communities, and particularly communities of color, in the United States for a very long time. And quite honestly, are angry. And they're angry because it took a whole bunch of white folk to become addicted and to change our approach to a health approach as opposed to a criminal justice approach. And I think it's really important for us to remember that. I think it's really important for us, as we see overdoses among Hispanics and African Americans start increasing, that we not lose the momentum that we have gained in terms of our therapeutic and compassionate response to this epidemic. It's really important for us to do that. So Sam talked about overprescribing, and in 2012, in the height of the prescribing, we were prescribing enough prescription pain medication to give every American their own bottle of pain pills, right? So here's, this is always my stunning example. When I was the director of addiction services in Massachusetts, I had this great dentist. I did what I was supposed to do. I disclosed the fact that I was in recovery. He knew I was a state director, and after a dental procedure, he said, "Michael, would you like a prescription for Percocets?" And I'm like, "Doc, I am not the guy you should be prescribing Percocets to." So it's not just about, even when you disclose the fact that you're at risk, often medical providers don't know what to do with that. So since the peak in 2012, we've seen some decreases in opioid prescribing, significant variations by state that I'll show you, largely as a function of often state legislation as it relates to prescribing limits.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's talk features Michael Botticelli, former White House Director of National Drug Policy. He spoke at the first annual Governor Mills Opioid Response Summit at the Augusta Civic Center.
So Sam talked about this, and I'm sorry to say that it was actually one of the seminal articles, I can't say study, that set off this opioid epidemic came out of Boston University Medical Center. And it was basically a 100-word paragraph in JAMA talking about an observational study where very few hospitalized patients were addicted, right? And so that study was often used by pharmaceutical companies. Folks at Johns Hopkins looked at citations for that and saw that it was cited over 600 times, most of them inaccurate. And this was a quote from the New York Times by Harold Jick. He said, "I'm essentially mortified that the letter to the editor was used as an excuse to do what these companies did. And I am so glad that Maine and other states are holding pharmaceutical companies and distributors accountable for their actions." It's high time that they acknowledge to parents, to other affected communities, that they had some culpability and responsibility for the work that they're doing. I show this map because prescribing rates vary greatly by state, with some states prescribing three times more than other states in terms of the number of prescriptions. And we don't really know kind of precisely kind of what's behind that. But I think it's really important to understand where you are relative to other states as it relates to opioid prescriptions. If I put a map up there around opioid-related overdoses, there would be a near-perfect correlation between overdose rates for prescription opioids and opioid prescribing. This is a, I think, interesting piece, and Sam talked about it before. So this is information from the National Survey on Drug Use and Health. And it basically looks at, I know it's a little bit of a busy slide, but it looks at the non-medical use of opioids. Basically, if you are not taking opioids for a legitimate medical purposes, where did they come from? Well, you see that big gray bar, right? And that is given by a friend or family for free. So what happens? You go to the doctor, you go to the dentist, you get a 30-day prescription for opioids. You maybe take very little of it, or you don't take any of it. You know, we're all taught as consumers to be medication hoarders, right? So, you know, we stick it in our medicine cabinet, save it for a rainy day, and, you know, feel free to give it to friends and family. And we know that that is often where people who start misusing prescription pain medication get prescription pain medication. So not only do we have to reduce the oversupply, but how do we continue to make sure that people are getting those medications out of their medicine cabinet? What you'll see is as that chart goes on, so the bottom looks at the number of days that people misuse those medications, and think of it as a marker for people becoming addicted, right? So as they become addicted, you know, what happens is, you know, you can't get them from doctors anymore, so you start buying them on the street. And we know that prescription pain medication, you know, on the street can often be much more expensive than what Sam described as a very cheap, very powerful heroin that's in many of our communities. You know, I also have to pause for a minute just to acknowledge that those of us in New England, we have always had historically higher heroin use rates than the rest of the country. And I remember when I was in Massachusetts and methamphetamine, the first wave of methamphetamine years ago was kind of overtaking the country. And we saw all sorts of congressional action and congressional money coming for methamphetamine. And those of us in New England are saying, what are you doing about heroin? Because methamphetamine, at least then, was not our issue. So, you know, we can't continue to look at these as kind of single drug issues. But we also know that those folks quickly transitioned to heroin, largely because untreated addiction, people often move to one more potent substance to the other, but largely for economic reasons, that it's just cheaper to buy heroin on the streets than it was prescription pain medication. So we are now, I think, you know, approaching kind of like many epidemics, they evolve over time. And I think it's important for us to know and to continue to pay attention to this issue. You know, I will say, and I didn't put this on my pre-existing conditions slides, but one of the areas that I think really exacerbated this problem is really poor data. You know, it's really hard when you are a federal official and you're looking 2 years ago in your rearview mirror trying to determine what's not only happening on the street now, but what's ahead of you and what's around the corner. And so I think it's really important. And so, you know, and I know that's been a tremendous amount of effort here in Maine and in other places to get better and more timely and more localized data so that you can really, you know, from a precise standpoint, target what you're doing. So these are data that you're all familiar with, and you see that teal line. You know, the green line is prescription pain medication, and we're beginning to see some leveling off. And then you saw heroin take over, and now fentanyl just dramatically increasing for all the reasons that people talked about. And you'll also see there what's already been articulated is dramatic increases in cocaine and methamphetamine use. So I think this is not just an opioid epidemic. This is a drug epidemic that we're experiencing here. You know, clearly it's an evolving epidemic of people moving to heroin and then fentanyl. I will also tell you data here in Maine and in Massachusetts show that the vast majority of deaths are really a function of polysubstance use issues, right? So it's not just pain medication or heroin or fentanyl. It's a combination of drugs that people are saying. So I think this is really the fourth wave of this epidemic is really polysubstance use related issues. So, you know, I keep saying this is more than just an opioid epidemic. I think that, you know, everybody in this room probably knows that, but we have to continue to pay attention to other substances if we're really going to make progress on this. So the good news is that some states are making progress. So Massachusetts announced another modest gain in reduction in overdose deaths, as well as Maine. And I think it is important for us, again, you know, the governor talked about this, certainly by no means reason to celebrate, but, you know, but at least it appears like some of the things that we are doing are working. And so where is the evidence taking us around what we think is really important? I will give you kind of what I think kind of the three crucial ingredients are, is insurance coverage so people can get care, the widespread use of naloxone to keep people alive, and timely access to treatment, and particularly timely access to treatment that involves a medication for opioid use disorders. And we'll talk a little bit about more about that. I think it's also important that we understand the other health consequences of this disease, that we also know we've seen significant increases in viral hepatitis associated with injection drug use. I think disturbingly, we've seen localized outbreaks of HIV in parts of the country. In Scott County, Indiana, many of us remember the huge outbreak of HIV in a very, very small county. I think there were over 300 cases of HIV associated with needle sharing among people who were injecting drugs. And closer to home for us in Lowland, Lawrence, and Boston, I'll talk about syringe service programs, but I actually think it's deplorable that there has been legislation in Massachusetts that has enabled syringe service programs with local approval. Lowland Lawrence has always had, historically had, an injection drug use problem, but it wasn't until they had an outbreak of HIV that they finally approved a syringe service program. And the governor talked about dramatic increases in neonatal abstinence syndrome resulting from this. Here's another great tragedy of this epidemic, if you ask me. And I'm not a government official anymore, so I feel free to say my mind. Not that I held back before, but we have highly effective treatments for people with opioid use disorder. We have indisputable evidence that if you get people on a medication and keep people on a medication, that their chances of achieving recovery are better than without it. And this is astounding to me. So this is a study done by Dr. Mark LaRochelle, who's with us at Boston Medical Center. And he looked at close to 18,000 overdose survivors. So we know people who've had a non-fatal event are much more likely to have a fatal event. And I'll skip to the last part, but we could actually achieve significant reductions in deaths by getting people particularly on methadone and buprenorphine, right? 53% and 37%. But the great tragedy is only 3 in 10% of those people are actually getting on a medication. And I'm really glad that you have enacted legislation here for emergency departments, because we know that emergency department initiation of buprenorphine is actually better than our historic practice of just treating and streeting people and letting them go. And Andrew talked, I think, you know, quite compellingly about his interaction with the system. So we know if we can get people, and I'll say this again, you know, part of the, this is not about belief. This is not about ideology. This is about science, right? And so some of us at the federal level got to work with Dr. Nora Volkoff. And if you don't know Nora, she is the director of the National Institute of Drug Abuse. We conduct the world's most robust research agenda. And someone asked her if she believed in medications. And she said, this is not about what I believe. This is about science, right? So those of us, and I think, again, those of us in the recovery community, like, I think we have a special responsibility to not dictate other people's pathway to recovery, because it's not our own. And it really disturbs me when a former Secretary of Health and Human Services for the Trump administration said putting people on a medication is just substituting one drug for another. And he was a doctor. So we really need to bridge the gap here and really support people in getting them on a medication. So when I was the director in Massachusetts, we passed legislation, we passed new licensing regulations that said if you are an addiction provider in Massachusetts, you cannot deny people admission because they are on a prescribed medication, right? And we see that all the time. And I will say this, and again, I'm gonna be provocative, I do not believe that you should be in business as an addiction provider and not support people on medications. People need all the other recovery supports. They need long-term residential. They need recovery coaches. You know, but this is the 21st century, and the evidence is clear. And I can't help but look at those data and say we can reduce these deaths now by getting people on a medication. Okay, so off my soapbox. So where's the evidence taking us? You know, those of us who've been doing this for a long time, when epidemics come at you, especially new epidemics like this one with a prescribed, you know, people are like, oh my God, what do we do here? It's not like the normal toolbox. So you do this scattershot approach, right? Shotgun approach. You shoot everything you can at it, and you hope that something works, right? And I think we're beginning to understand that there are some effective things that we can do. And many folks talked about this. This is not a single bullet strategy. This is like an all of the above strategy. These are all things that we need to be doing. So we talked about the importance of reducing opioid prescribing. Sam talked about the fact that we have to make sure that we also are dealing with people's pain appropriately, right? And lots of anecdotal stories about people who are doing well on opioids for chronic pain who are getting, unfortunately, involuntarily tapered off these medications, and we can't do that either. But we have to make sure that we're moving away from opioid prescribing, particularly for people with acute pain, and looking at things like alternative pain management strategies, acupuncture, CBT, physical therapy, and working with our insurance companies to incentivize them and to reimburse for them. We talked about the role of prescription drug monitoring programs, and I think we've seen some success around the country in physicians checking databases to make sure that people are not going from one doctor to another, or they're not getting prescriptions of benzodiazepines and opioids that exacerbate overdose risk. Talking about the importance of safe storage and disposal, making sure that people are disposing of medications and storing them safely in their house. We need to do a better job of better diagnosis and linkage to care. So we talked about the opportunities for emergency department interventions. So this was based on a study out of Yale University that showed that if we can actually start people on a medication while they're in the emergency department, it has better results in just doing a warm handoff and a referral and basically just giving a list of people, giving people a list of programs to call. And also understanding that many people who are in our inpatient beds are there for an underlying substance use condition that we are totally ignoring and not paying attention to. So hospital-based services like addiction consultation service. So we have an addiction consultation service at BMC where where docs can order an intervention and will actually start inducting people on treatment, do a warm handoff to the community. Part of our focus federally and as a state is how do we make sure that we're expanding access to treatment and particularly medications for opioid use disorder treatment. We talked about the importance of healthcare coverage and a robust treatment benefit to do that. We talked about the importance of building capacity in our primary care settings, and I think that's really important for us to do. We are never going to have enough bricks and mortar addiction treatment programs, but also we need to do a better job of integrating care. And as Andrew talked about, like we need that one-stop shop for people to do it. So we actually have a primary care clinic serving over 800 active patients on buprenorphine where they can get care for their viral hepatitis and they can get care for all the other medical conditions that they have. We need to continue to increase the number of waiver professionals to do it, and I'm glad that Dr. Patrice Harris is here, our colleague from the AMA. Buprenorphine was approved for use in 2002. Right? And we could debate about whether or not we need the waiver to be able to do that. But I think last estimate showed only between 4 and 6% of doctors in the United States have gone through the waiver training. And I think part of what we need to say is, again, you don't have to have a buprenorphine waiver. And I know that there are other supports that people need to be able to do that. But again, I think we have to make sure that we're saying that addiction can't be an optional healthcare activity. So at Boston Medical Center, our CEO has basically mandated that all of our emergency room docs, all of our psychiatrists, all of our primary care docs, all our family medicine docs, and who am I missing? I'm missing some folks, actually have to go through the waiver training process to work at Boston Medical Center. And just as our way of saying, like, you have to have some competencies around addiction. We also know, and we worked with our colleagues in Congress to increase the cap on patients who are being served, another thing that we could debate about. But also, how do we continue to build treatment capacity in what I call treatment deserts? And I'm sure Maine is a very rural state. There are parts of Massachusetts that are very rural. And how do we think about building capacity in what I call treatment deserts? So I go back to Scott County, Indiana, that had no addiction treatment programs, and they had one doc who was buprenorphine waivered. Right, so we need to make sure. There was a study that I saw that about 40% of counties in the United States did not have a buprenorphine trained doctor. So it's important for us to do that. I'll just kind of wrap up here. Clearly continue to enforce federal parity rules. I think this is particularly true with commercial insurance and particularly true with commercial insurance around medication. So working with your division of insurance to make sure, and HHS and the Department of Labor to make sure that we're processing complaints and holding insurance companies to make sure they're meeting their legal obligation under parity. Clearly, expanding naloxone availability and co-prescribing is really important. Again, I think what we've seen, studies have shown that naloxone in communities lowers overdose risk, and that the more naloxone we can get out into communities, the more we can reduce overdose risk. The Attorney General, the Surgeon General, that was a big misspeak. But the Surgeon General has actually called for people to carry naloxone, as well as looking at co-prescribing. So if you have a history of a substance use disorder, if you're on a benzodiazepine, if you're on an opioid, you should automatically be getting a prescription for naloxone. I talked about opportunities and what I think is really important to increase access to syringe service programs. I think the federal government should allow those municipalities that want to experiment with what I call overdose prevention sites. I think it's particularly important that they allow, and they did it with marijuana. So anyway, the other piece, and I think we heard quite astonishingly, is, you know, in order to decrease stigma, we really need to talk about this in a personal way. Right? So this is a really good example, and studies have shown that science and data alone don't change public opinion, right? We wouldn't be debating climate change or immunization or any of the other things where we have the scientific evidence to be able to do that. And there's lots of data to show that sympathetic narrative changes people's minds. So how do we continue to use your stories and Andrew's stories as a way to change people's minds, because we can no longer see addiction as the disease of other. And the only way that we can do that is by being public. I've shared this story publicly. We had a good week in Washington, Gene, when the Supreme Court upheld the Affordable Care Act, and it was also the same week that they struck down the Defense of Marriage Act and made same-sex legal in the United States. And my husband and I, it's wild. It's a good week. And so my husband and I were living on Capitol Hill at the time, and we went to the steps of the Supreme Court. It's still one of the most moving experiences I've ever had in my life. You know, and on myopic, I look at everything through a substance use lens, right? And I couldn't help but think of being on those steps and think of the miraculous change in not only public opinion, but public policy and law in the 50 years since Stonewall, right? It's remarkable. And no small part was that achieved by people's courage to come out publicly to their family, to their friends, to their employers, and to their neighbors, right? So please, please, please do not underestimate the power of story and storytelling and changing people's hearts and minds. I think it's something that we have to do, and I'm glad that that is happening. Last two I'll talk about, I think my time is up, I'm probably over, is we have to reform the language that we use to refer to addiction and people with substance use disorders. And I am not asking you to be politically correct, right? There's a scientific underpinning to this. So some of you know Dr. John Kelly, he runs the Recovery Research Institute at Mass General Hospital, did this really interesting study with trained mental health clinicians, right? So this is not a naive public. And he gave them near identical vignettes of a person with an addiction. And the only thing he changed was in one, he referred to them as a person with a substance use disorder, and the other one as a substance abuser. And what he found was statistically significant differences. When you talked about someone as a substance abuser, even among mental health clinicians, it was more likely to elicit a punitive response than a therapeutic response with a person with a substance use disorder, right? And so think about it, like the words that we use, addict, junkie, clean, dirty, right? And so if we, our words reflect our values about people. So think of the language that we used to use about people with mental illnesses that we just don't use anymore. So on our website, we actually have a pledge about and your commitment to only use clinically appropriate, non-stigmatizing language. We sent it out to all the employees at Boston Medical Center 2 years ago for Recovery Day and asked them to sign on to it. And it's a simple thing that we can do that actually does make a difference. And we can actually work with the media in getting them to change their language as they relate. One of our last acts at the Obama administration, we sent out a memo to all the departments asking them to only use clinically appropriate language when we refuse. If we want to be seen as a disease, our language has to reflect that we're a disease. And the last thing I'll say, I know we have a number of law enforcement and criminal justice folks here, and I want to thank you for what the work that you've been doing. And I think if there's been a silver lining out of this epidemic, has been the way that law enforcement has changed their approach to addiction. And I think that none of us... I'm looking at Mark, that none of us in public health could have ever thought possible, right? So not only do we have law enforcement and criminal justice folks understanding that we can't arrest and incarcerate our way out of the problem, I can't tell you how many town hall meetings I went to where I asked the chief of police, what's one thing you want from the federal government? And he didn't want more police officers, he didn't want more drug task force, he wanted more treatment in their communities. And it was really important to understand that people who get treatment don't commit crime. Imagine that. But it was really amazing. So not only in terms of their ability to carry naloxone, but we have police forces all over the country who are actually helping people get into treatment, and in many ways taking up the void of our healthcare delivery system in terms of the work that you're doing. So really want to thank you. And I do think this is a really good example of how public health and public safety can work hand in hand in terms of the work that we do. So I really want to give a shout out to our criminal justice and law enforcement partners in terms of the work that you've been doing. It's really, I think you have also changed, I think between you and parents, you have dramatically changed the conversation in the United States as it relates to our treatment of people with substance use disorders. So I have to say, just thank you for being here. Having done work in New England for a long time, to be filled with a room with leadership and by people coming together. I was telling Sam last night, I continue to with attribution to use his line, that when I went around the country, we did a lot of town hall meetings. And while opioids and this epidemic might have been the reason to convene people, it was really about bringing community together. And New England particularly, when you go back to the history of this country, it's been about town hall meetings and communities coming together. And so we really have a long history in this country of how we come together as a community to solve our most pressing problems and to actually protect the most vulnerable people that we have. So I really want to thank you for being here today. I want to thank you for your leadership and really want to continue to support the work that you're doing. So thank you very much.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's speaker was Michael Botticelli, former White House Director of National Drug Control Policy. He currently serves as the Executive Director of the Graykin Center for Addiction at the Boston Medical Center. He recently spoke at the first annual Governor Mills Opioid Response Summit at the Augusta Civic Center. If you missed part of the program or want to hear it again, you can always find it on our website, mainpublic.org. Click on radio to access this program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Music in this hour comes from our alarm clock. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and Speaking in Maine is edited by me, Lucy Suchek. Thanks for joining us.